It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, older workers can face a lot of hurdles when it comes to getting jobs, and it can be really difficult to prove age discrimination in court. Our guest is looking for changes in the laws and at the workplace.
First, a deal between Wisconsin and the Taiwanese electronics manufacturer Foxconn have been touted as a potential economic boon to the state. The 15-year deal is currently being talked about in the state legislature, and it's estimated to bring over 10,000 jobs to southeastern Wisconsin. An incentive bill was passed by an assembly committee yesterday.
The deal could cost the state upwards of $3 billion, and the threat of a potential economic downturn and a slow return on investment has some lawmakers warning that the Foxconn deal might not be prudent.
Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter, and she's been covering this story. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So an incentive deal went through in an assembly committee yesterday. What happened with that voting?
So the assembly committee voted 8-5 along party lines. So Republicans voted for the incentive package and Democrats voted against it. Last night, around probably about 5:30 in the evening, it was a much quicker assembly hearing than at least I had anticipated. It started at 3 p.m. and I think we were expecting a later night of debate between Republicans and Democrats, because this has been, you know, as you know, a very contentious and high profile issue, this $3 billion incentive package. But there was certainly some back and forth, but they wrapped up the vote after about 3 hours last night.
And as you said, it was a party line vote. What are Democrats' objections to the deal?
Well, Democrats have a number of objections to the deal. For the most part, kind of an overarching statement is that they don't think it's a good investment for the state of Wisconsin. They think it's too expensive. The amount of money in tax incentives that the state is paying out isn't worth it for the number of jobs that Foxconn might create in Wisconsin. That's up to 13,000 jobs is the peak of the estimate for the number of jobs the facility would create. And they also think that there aren't enough protections in the bill as it exists right now for Wisconsin taxpayers that are paying for this incentive package. So Democrats actually proposed 23 different amendments to the bill last night in this assembly committee, and all 23 of those were voted down.
Including one that would incentivize keeping the workers in Wisconsin. It sounds like there was concern that Wisconsin would be subsidizing a company that employed a lot of workers from Illinois.
That's right. That's been a really big part of the debate about this Foxconn bill, is how many people are going to cross the border from Illinois and take these jobs at Foxconn. Foxconn is projected to be located in the southeastern part of the state, obviously pretty accessible to Illinois. In those financial estimates that we got from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, they estimated that even 10% of Foxconn workers coming from Illinois would push back the amount of time it would take for the state of Wisconsin to break even on the deal. So these people coming from across the border and taking Foxconn jobs is certainly something that folks have been concerned about, opponents have been concerned about. And so one of those amendments would have put language in the bill that would have required Foxconn to give preference to Wisconsin residents when they applied for jobs, and Wisconsin companies when they submitted bids to be vendors for Foxconn.
And Republicans singing a different tune, certainly on this committee, but they also wanted to attach an amendment or two. What did they say yesterday?
Yeah, so Republicans introduced their amendments to the deal, which certainly did not number all the way to 23. It was a more condensed package last week. And those changes weren't incredibly substantial. One of the things that Committee Chair Adam Nalin told me when I interviewed him last week about this was they really didn't want to make changes to the memorandum of understanding that the governor had announced with Foxconn, because they didn't want to compromise the deal. So some of the things that they did were just kind of clarifying language. They did include language in their amendment that encourages the state's Economic Development Agency, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, to include encouragements to hire Wisconsin workers in the final contract with Foxconn. But he said that they can't have a requirement for hiring Wisconsin workers because of some constitutional limitations, that would violate the Constitution to put those requirements in there. Another piece of the Republican amendment would provide $20 million in worker training in the next budget to kind of provide some more trained workers, build the workforce up for Foxconn.
Now, Republicans have had a lot of agreement on Foxconn, but they haven't exactly been speaking with one voice. And I know that Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald had said that he had some reservations for a while, but I understand he may have changed his opinion somewhat. Where is he right now?
So what we're hearing from the Senate, which is certainly moving more slowly than the Assembly, is that they are looking toward a public hearing on the Foxconn deal next week. Senator Fitzgerald told us last week that he was expecting August 22nd to be the big day, so next Tuesday, to be the first step in the process for the Senate on Foxconn. It would be a public hearing in the Joint Finance Committee, and senators will be able to do what the Assembly did, you know, last night and the previous week, which is just talk about this deal in public, invite some people in, ask questions, and then debate amongst themselves and either vote the incentive package down or pass it out of committee and send it to the full Senate.
Laurel White is with us right now, State Capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, and she's with us now to talk about the latest developments on Foxconn incentives. And Laurel, a bit ago, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau released its assessment of the Foxconn incentive deal. Remind us what they said.
Well, the big headline out of that Legislative Fiscal Bureau analysis, and for folks that don't know, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau is nonpartisan. It's often called the legislature's budget office, so they crunch the numbers on bills and proposals and kind of share fiscal implications. So their big news on the Foxconn package was that the state wouldn't break even on the deal until the year 2043. And break even in this case means collecting income tax revenue that equals the amount that the state has paid out in tax incentives.
And these numbers, as I understand it, are drawn from sort of the rosiest projections of Foxconn's basis here.
That's right. Yeah. So those economic estimates by the Legislative Fiscal Bureau are assuming two big things. One, that Foxconn hires 13,000 employees, which is the maximum number that it's estimated to employ in Wisconsin, and that 100% of that 13,000 are from Wisconsin. Those are all Wisconsin workers. So, you know, we mentioned before, some people are concerned that some of those workers are going to come from Illinois, the facility being located pretty close to Illinois. So the Legislative Fiscal Bureau also included in their estimate, if 10% of Foxconn workers came from Illinois, they said that break-even point would get pushed from 2043 to 2045. And if it was more than that, it would be well beyond, they said.
So we have these concerns among some people that the deal would take quite a while to pay off. On the other hand, there's also some news that the Wisconsin economy might be slowing down. What are lawmakers worried about there when it comes to the economy in Wisconsin?
Well, this is kind of a wonky tax collections thing, but I think the easiest way to explain it is that tax collections are coming in a little bit more slowly than had been projected. So as of the end of May of this year, tax collections for the state of Wisconsin were about 2.5%, and the projected revenue growth, which is the things that, you know, lawmakers use to build budgets and things like that, was projected to be 2.7%. So things were just a little bit behind. And we'll get updated actual collection numbers in the coming months. But what happens is if the collections aren't as much as was projected, lawmakers are going to have to change the budget a little bit, rearrange some things because they won't have as much money in the bank as they thought they were going to.
And so for Foxconn, does that mean the legislature puts a little more money aside for a rainy day?
Yeah, I mean, it gets really tricky when you talk about Foxconn. I mean, the reason that Foxconn is important here is because it's an expensive thing for the state of Wisconsin going forward if it is approved by the legislature. At its peak, the deal will cost taxpayers about $325 million a year. So if the state is looking at an economic slowdown in the coming years, it's going to be bringing less money in and having this kind of recurring payment on the books, right, for 15 years out. So lawmakers are just discussing how to be responsible and have maybe a little bit more of a reserve fund in the coming budget to kind of prepare for the future.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is the State Capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News with us to talk about the latest developments on Foxconn incentives.
Right now, a lot of older workers can face bias in the workplace, but actually proving age discrimination in a court of law can be a pretty tall order.
Our next guest says a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision will make it even harder for older workers to make their case. He says Congress and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission need to take action on the issue.
Chris Farrell joins us now. He's a senior economics contributor for American Public Media's Marketplace and author of the book Unretirement: How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Way We Think About Work, Community, and the Good Life. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Before we get to this Supreme Court decision, Chris, what are some of the challenges older workers face when trying to get and I guess keep jobs?
Well, older workers face age discrimination. You know, they don't want to work as many hours, and they're set in their ways, and they don't really know too much about technology. And, you know, if we hire them, they're going to go file for Social Security very soon. So do we really want to invest in their training? I mean, you can kind of just, you know, just spin off all the kinds of prejudices and stereotypes that are out there about older workers. And the reality is older workers are creative, they're productive, and we live in a society where people overall on average are healthier, they're better educated, and they want to continue to work longer. And frankly, since our retirement savings system is not particularly good, they need to keep working longer in order to generate some income. So this is really a fundamental issue in our marketplace today. Lots of management, lots of human resources, hiring people have deep prejudices against older workers, and it's a tough fight.
And even tougher, you write, after U.S. Supreme Court decision earlier this summer. What happened there?
So what happened is the Supreme Court upheld a lower court decision, and what this it was a at the time, 2007, it was a gentleman, he was 49 years old, and he applied for, with Reynolds Tobacco, it was a managerial, territorial sales position. And he never got a response back. And then later on, because of some other lawsuit, it came out that job reviewers were told to stay away from applicants whose resumes said that they'd been in sales for 8 to 10 years. And what the courts did is they dismissed his suit because he alleged age discrimination. It sounds like age discrimination to me, probably sounds like age discrimination to you. And what the court ruled was two things. One is they said, look, the law protects existing employees, not job applicants. This is really, I mean, seriously? And then the other thing is the court said that he hadn't tried hard enough to figure out why he didn't hear back from the company. But that one has also really upset a lot of people because it's really hard to find out why a company hasn't offered you a job or gotten back to you. And in fact, it was only because of another lawsuit that he found out the real reason.
As I understand it, it's hard to prove discrimination in hiring decisions, and particularly hard when it comes to age discrimination. Can you talk about that?
So very hard. So the Supreme Court, there's a 2009, it's a landmark Supreme Court ruling. It's called Gross versus FBL Financial Services. But the core point of that ruling is what the court said is, look, if you want to prove age discrimination, it has to be the primary factor behind the bias claim. So as you can imagine, this is very difficult to prove. If this is the factor you have to prove. And so that has, ever since that has been ruled, there's really been kind of reluctance among lawyers and, you know, to bring age discrimination suits. It's a very high bar to beat. And also, if you just figure, a lot of people normally are reluctant to bring age discrimination suits because you sort of say, well, okay, it's age discrimination. I have a pretty good idea that's what's going on here, but, you know, I don't know if I can prove it. Plus, fact is, I want to get a job. So I'm going to go get myself out into the job market. And so with an aging population, with an aging workforce, this is becoming an increasingly important issue. And yet at the same time, what the court is ruling is saying, look, we're going to make it really hard for you to ever prove age discrimination.
Let's talk about the companies involved here. You mentioned in this one case that there was some kind of HR information saying, yeah, we don't want somebody with 8 or 10 or more years of experience. And might some companies be saying, hey, we want, fresh faces right out of college or the certification program or whatever?
Right. So there's all kinds of subtle things. Where the this sort of concerns about age discrimination is really moving, and it's a very tough area. So there's a lot of protections for existing employees, and the fact of the matter is, if you look at companies, it's pretty rare these days where they're going to send, a company's going to have an email that says, let's get rid of our older workers. Right, they don't do that anymore, and they know how to do it. They know if they're going to restructure a division. They kind of know how to work with their existing employees. Where there is a black hole and a lot of issue, and we suspect there's a lot going on, is in the hiring process. So you lose your job because of restructuring or a layoff, or your company closes down its division, and you're looking for a job. You know, just the sort of things that you're talking about. Are they with these ads that say, you know, 2 or 3 years experience? Well, why shouldn't I go ahead and apply for that job? And there have been some interesting academic studies where they send out the same resume across the country or within an industry, and everything's the same except for the age. And what you find out is that the younger person is invited back much more frequently than the older person is invited back for the subsequent interview. So this, if we want people to be working longer, and I think we do want people to be working longer, and lots of people do want to be working longer, the shift in focus is moving toward these subtle barriers on the hiring side, but that also is a very difficult area to prove.
Chris Farrell is with us, senior economics contributor for Marketplace, looking at age discrimination in the American workforce. Chris, you're looking for some changes in a recent piece you wrote. You say, among other things, you'd like to see changes in laws from Congress.
Well, I would. Now, in this Congress, right at this point in time, we're not going to get a change in law, but you can still be pushing for change. So, for example, there is this bipartisan Protecting Older Workers Against Discrimination Act. And what this essentially does is it restores what used to be before the Supreme Court said it, age discrimination has to be your primary cause. So it just kind of goes back to where we were. And there's an area which I think is extremely important, which is to allow for sex plus age claims, because older women in particular face a lot of discrimination. And so if they can file suits under sex plus age, I think it increases the odds, if they are facing discrimination, it would increase their odds of being able to make a viable case. And there's also this kind of interesting idea that's out there. It came from a professor at New York Law School that I talked to, Samuel S. Stryker. And he was arguing for a safe harbor. And what he said is, look, a lot of employers, if you talk to them off the record, you're not writing down their name, they will just give you all these stereotypes about these older workers and why they won't hire them. So he said, let's create a safe harbor. And what the safe harbor says, you hire someone for 2 to 3 years. And during that 2-3 year period, you can fire them and you will not face an age discrimination lawsuit. Now, you can't do any other kind of discrimination. All the other employment laws are in place. But let's address their concern head on. And his bet, and I think he's right about this, the bet's going to be this older worker is creative, this older worker is productive, and the management will learn that was a stereotype, that was prejudice. I think that's kind of a creative halfway house idea while we wait for Congress and the White House to do something that really will help workers more. But right now, they're not interested in doing that.
There's also the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, a federal commission. Yep. What could they do to change this?
They could be, they could be just much more aggressive in enforcing cases. And there was a case called Texas Roadhouse, 2011. They recently settled a $12 million settlement. And in Texas Roadhouse, they didn't want older people out there with the customer, and that was was pretty clear, and there was a pretty clear trail there. But anyway, they negotiated a settlement, and so I think that the EEOC, the employment, they can be much more aggressive in tackling this issue and really push the margin and really send a signal to employers, look, this is not acceptable. We have an aging population. We have an aging workforce. It is not acceptable to indulge in this kind of age discrimination in this era. It's over. So aggressive enforcement by the EEOC, I think, would really send an important signal to corporate America.
Also, there's the idea of maybe a culture change to recognize some of the things you've been talking about for employers who want to make sure they're playing fair and have access to potentially valuable older employees. What kind of advice would you have for them?
Well, what I have advice is some of what you're seeing a little bit in Wisconsin. I know we're seeing it here in Minnesota, where the manufacturing workforce is an older than average workforce. And all of a sudden, it's anecdotal, it's not everybody, but you're getting more companies are realizing, hey, we don't want these older workers to retire. There's a lot of skill, there's a lot of knowledge here. You want to have a phased retirement? You want to do a semi-retirement? You want to work with a flexible schedule? What can we do to keep you around for, at least a couple of more years? Because the economy is doing better, the unemployment rate's reasonably low. And so I think that what if employers give their older workers the opportunity to exercise their creativity and their skill, they will be rewarded enormously. What is happening right now with management and employers complaining that they can't find the workers that they need, they're beginning, and they're only just beginning, but they are beginning to look at their older workers with sort of a more appreciative eye. And I think we should be taking advantage of that as much as possible.
As we wrap up, Chris, any advice for older people out in the workforce looking for jobs? I know one size fits all can be tough to do depending on where they are, the kind of work they want to do. But any general advice for them?
So the main general advice is for an older worker, it's really hard to get a job through the front door with a resume contacting human resources. Contact your network, the former people that you used to work with, your former colleagues, your former employees, some of your current, your neighbors, your friends, the people at where you worship. Network as much as possible, because your network, they don't care how old you are. They know what you can do, and they'd like to help you out. That's how you get a job.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Chris Farrell, senior economics contributor for American Public Media's Marketplace. He's the author of the book On Retirement, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Way We Think About Work, Community, and the Good Life. President Trump has gotten criticism from his own party and beyond for his response to this weekend's events in Charlottesville, Virginia, especially his initial reaction over the weekend.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides. It's been going on for a long time in our country.
After facing pressure to directly denounce white supremacy, President Trump spoke again yesterday.
Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans.
President Trump, speaking this afternoon now at a press conference, has said he blames in part the alt-left for inciting violence in Charlottesville, saying, quote, you had a group on one side, you had a group on the other, and they came at each other with clubs, and it was vicious, and it was horrible, and it was a horrible thing to watch, and appeared to defend at least some of the participants on the white supremacist side of the rallies.
Trump isn't the first American president to deal with issues of race and white supremacy in each era since the Civil War, has had new debates, controversies, and challenges. Our next guest says each president has a responsibility to send a clear message on race, and many of them have fallen short.
Eric Foner is a professor of history at Columbia University. He's written a lot of books about American history, including Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, 1863 to 1877, Who Owns History, Rethinking the Past in a Changing World, and Battles for Freedom, the Use and Abuse of American History. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Very happy to be here.
Well, stepping away from the particulars of this moment and the current president, what ideally should be the role of an American president when speaking and acting on race?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing is the president, whatever party he or she may be from, needs to condemn racism in the strongest possible language, not to make excuses for it, not to suggest that it's just one problem among many. I would have liked to see President Trump say, look, these are racist groups who are inciting the violence in Charlottesville, and racism has no place in America, but it is still a deep problem. Now, he edged toward that after a couple of days, as you know, you just said, quoted his remarks there. But when he gave that second comment, it was like a kid eating his spinach. It was obvious that these were not his words, and that you know, he didn't really find it very comfortable to say that. But more to the point, you know, this is a president who used pretty explicitly racism as part of his political campaign, and you know, appealed directly to white, what we call white nationalism, or whatever term you want to use for that part of the political spectrum. So, you know, in his first statement, he was not willing to condemn people who are part, only part, not the whole thing, of his base. You want a president who will rise above that. You know, in 1963, at the height of the Birmingham crisis, President Kennedy went on TV to say the country faces a moral crisis here over racial inequality. Now, he was speaking against a lot of people who had voted for him. He carried most of the segregationist South in 1960, when the South was the so-called solid Democratic South. Kennedy was willing to confront people who had supported him. Trump is not willing to do that.
And this was a consistent theme for Democrats for a long stretch. FDR and others had to confront it, where you had a Democratic Party that was in part dependent on the support of Southern segregationists. How did that party get to that moment you mentioned with JFK and then Lyndon Johnson, where they did make that transition?
Well, it took a good while. And, you know, FDR, who is praiseworthy on many grounds, did not really address race at all, and basically said, look, I've got to get things through Congress, and the Southern Democrats control the committees. So he shied away from that. His wife, Eleanor, was much more forthright than he was on this. And, you know, for a long time, after all, the Republicans were the party of Lincoln once, and there were plenty of Republicans who spoke out very strongly about racial justice. I mean, Jacob Javits, a senator from New York State, or even Robert Taft, very conservative, but in the late 40s in the Senate, he was quite adamant about racial inequality and the need to combat it. So, you know, there's nothing. The Republican Party doesn't have to go this way, but it has since Goldwater, since Nixon's Southern strategy. And by the same token, the Democrats increasingly, for many, many complicated reasons, one of which was the migration of large numbers of blacks out of the South to the North, where they could vote, unlike in the South, and allying increasingly with the Democratic Party, which was pushing for greater racial justice. You know, the parties have switched since, let's say, 100-some-odd years ago, when the Republicans were the party of anti-slavery and black rights, and the Democrats were the party of states' rights, slavery, and disenfranchising black people. They've switched positions now.
There was, in the 2016 campaign, a thought that maybe candidate Trump would be different than President Trump, that he would become presidential, grow in the office. Have we seen cases with past presidents where they have changed, evolved on issues of race after taking office?
Well, first of all, let me say no one in New York thought that Trump would change. You know, we knew Trump long before this, and as a celebrity, as a kind of baloney artist in New York City. With Trump, what you see is what you get. He's not going to change, so let's not hold our breath for that. And in a way, that's good in a weird sense, in that since he just speaks from the id immediately, what first comes out is what he really thinks. Later on, his advisors may kind of smooth over it, but, you know, the first statement, that is real Trump. He doesn't understand why Nazis and white supremacists ought to be condemned. You know, he just doesn't see it, so that's Trump. Later on, they say, hey, you better say something, so he does. But sure, Abraham Lincoln evolved. You know, before the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln did not support significant political and civil rights for black people. He thought the solution to the slavery question was to free the slaves, pay the slave owners monetary compensation, and then send the slaves to Africa or maybe Haiti or somewhere like that. He changed. He abandoned that. He, by the end of his life, he was much more favorably disposed toward what we would consider legal and civil equality and even black voting in some regards than he had been. People can change. I suppose one could hope that Trump will change, but it's been quite a while that he's been the same.
Talking to Eric Foner, historian at Columbia University, about race and presidential leadership. I wanted to get into the issue of the role of history and debates, still ongoing debates over the Civil War in modern-day America. This protest, of course, related to the removal of statues of Robert E. Lee, Confederate general. President Trump, in this press conference today, said George Washington was a slave owner. Well, we have to take down statues of George Washington. Can you talk about Civil War memorials and modern-day issues of race?
Did he say that? Well, it's amazing he knows anything about American history. He didn't mention that George Washington actually provided in his will for the freedom of all his slaves. Maybe worth noting by President Trump. You know, these statues, the debate over these statues, have little to do with the actual history, the Confederacy, the Civil War. You know, the statue on the University of Virginia campus, which was the focal point for all this violence, was erected in 1924, okay? That's basically 70 years after the end of the Civil War. And they're erected much more as a statement of power at the time than as something looking back 70 years. That was a period of segregation, of lynching, of the taking away the right to vote from black people in Virginia and other southern states. And these statues were basically put up to say, we are in charge, folks. White people are in charge, and here's the symbol of them, the Confederacy. Robert E. Lee was a well-known Virginian, obviously, and there's no reason you shouldn't have a statue of Robert E. Lee in Virginia. You know, the problem is now that the public monuments about history in the South are completely one-sided. Why don't we have a statue of John M. Langston, a black member of Congress in the 1880s from Virginia? Why don't we have statues of black Reconstruction legislators in Virginia? In other words, if all you've got is Confederate generals, you've got one piece of the region's history, but not the whole thing. What about statues to slave rebels? I mean, let's have Nat Turner. He's a Virginian. Well, he killed a lot of white people. Well, sure, so did Robert E. Lee, killed a lot of people, and yet there's no problem with a statue to him. I don't think these really have to do with history. They have to do with who's in charge. And, you know, that's why, let's say in South Carolina, when they put the Confederate flag on the State House, we had later taken down, of course, more recently, that was in the 1950s. As a statement against the civil rights movement. It had nothing to do with the Confederacy. It was kind of in your face to black people in South Carolina. You're trying to get your rights, but we want to show you who's in charge here. So, you know, now people are trying to suggest maybe there should be a different kind of a more diversified view of Virginia society. And, you know, I would agree with that. Whether it means taking down statues is a different question, but I would say put up statues to other types of people in the history of Virginia who are not represented at all in the public monuments today.
We're talking about presidential leadership on issues of race. Historian Eric Foner is with us. He's a professor of history at Columbia University, author of a number of books, including Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, 1863 to 1877.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from President Trump when it comes to the events in Charlottesville on issues of race and of white nationalism? Is there a past president that you think did especially well or maybe especially badly on issues of race? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with historian Eric Foner from Columbia University. We're looking at the role of presidential leadership in racially divided times.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from the president of the United States when it comes to leadership on issues of race and reactions to white supremacy? Is there a president in American history who you think did things right or wrong? And what questions do you have for our guest? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Eric, I wanted to ask you about modern-day America compared to a couple points in history when we saw the rise of the Ku Klux Klan and affiliated movements. Reconstruction era and the reaction, 1920s, you had groups of white Americans feeling economically insecure, worried that they were losing ground relative to, in particular, but not exclusively to black Americans, and that led to the rise of basically a domestic insurgency movement. Are we there again? Are we in a similar time period?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right that we have seen these kinds of things before. You know, the Know-Nothings became a rather prominent political party in the 1850s on an anti-immigrant, platform. Reconstruction, the original Ku Klux Klan was there and unfortunately succeeded in overturning biracial governments and putting the South on the path back to white supremacy. 1920s, absolutely. Internment of Japanese, you know, you can go on and on. In other words, Trump is kind of an extreme version of something that has existed in American society off and on at many points. So we shouldn't think he just landed from the moon, you know, and is completely outside of certain strands of American political culture. But with Trump, it's more explicit, so to speak. You know, at least more recently, you know, the Republican Party, since Goldwater, has been appealing to white resentment, white backlash against the gains of the civil rights movement. Nixon's Southern strategy, trying to win white Southerners to the Republicans away from the Democrats by appealing to racial fears. But it was usually done through kind of surreptitious language, you know, law and order or to reverse discrimination, whereas Trump, you know, ever since he started campaigning against Mexicans and then the way he talked about blacks, every one of them is living in hell, you know, and they're afflicted by crime and drugs, and that's it. They have absolutely nothing to lose. That's ridiculous. You know, now they see what they have to lose. They have a president with a white nationalist in the White House, Stephen Bannon. So I don't think there's been somebody like that so close to the president, although maybe Pat Buchanan might qualify when he was working for Nixon. But, you know, Trump, so this kind of extreme, well, neo-Nazis, or you might, you know, some of them are, has not had quite the prominence in, you know, in the politics that Trump is giving them today.
How much does presidential leadership matter in the sense of the bully pulpit in making some points of view acceptable, other points unacceptable on race? Does having a president who doesn't speak to issues of race empower extremes like white supremacy?
Well, Trump is, it's not simply Trump not speaking, it's what he does say when he does speak. And more to the point, maybe what his administration does. You know, you have an attorney general who is an arch segregationist or has been, and says, well, we're no, you know, affirmative action is to protect poor white people who are being discriminated against, you know, to the advantage of minorities, or the effort to suppress voting, not to mention Wisconsin, which is not my state, but in many states, including Wisconsin, all these efforts to suppress voting by poor people, minorities, you know, and Trump, of course, promoting that. So, you know, it's not just what they say, but what they do. But yes, of course, the president is supposed to speak for the nation. He's supposed to speak for the values of the nation. The problem with Trump, among others, is he seems to consider himself the president of those people who voted for him, not of the nation. And he doesn't want to say anything that will annoy the people who voted for him. So he doesn't reach out to those who didn't vote for him, but he is their president now. And, you know, this is not new. This started with his inaugural address, which didn't offer anything, reconciliation, nothing to people who had voted against him. It was all to, you know, whip up the people who were his supporters, and it's been that way ever since. So Trump doesn't really see himself as the president of the American people. He sees himself as the president of a specific group of Americans who elected him, but that's half the country, let us say, not the whole country. And most presidents try to build support outside this base, but he hasn't shown any interest in that.
Talking to historian Eric Foner from Columbia University about presidential leadership and race, President Trump's reactions to Charlottesville over the weekend, yesterday and now today, different messages coming out. Getting back to the whose statue stays up issue, Karen on Facebook writes, the Washington Lee issue is a red herring. Washington never led a rebellion against the United States. Should that participation in that rebellion make us think of people differently, I guess Karen is asking.
I suppose if the British had defeated George Washington in the American Revolutionary War, you wouldn't see too many statues of George Washington around right now. Look, I agree with the point that not every single person who was a slave owner should be denied recognition of one kind or another. But Lee, of course, was the leader of the Confederate armies against the government of the United States. Most places do not honor those who led a rebellion against the government. But as I said, Lee is an important Virginian. I don't really have a big problem with Lee being there if there were statues to other kinds of Virginians. The black Virginians, who were half, 50% almost, or 48% of the population of Virginia were black at that time. Those people were in favor of the Union. Lee didn't represent that. But they don't have a lot of recognition in the public statuary. And as I said, that's because these things are about the present, not about the past. They're about expressing power in the present that they are, you know, whenever the present is that they're put up. So, you know, in a way, it is a red herring. What we really should be talking about is how come African-Americans still, 150 years after the Civil War, are disadvantaged in so many ways.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Gil is with us in Madison. Gil, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up?
Well, he just spoke to it now. So the point I wanted to make was that these statues they're erecting were people who were enemies of the United States. And I can't see us ever erecting statues to enemies. It would be like putting up a statue of Hitler, because he certainly was part of our history. But we don't honor him or recognize him as a great hero. And even though that state is now part of the United States, that particular part of their history, they were in rebellion against the United States. And to recognize or honor people who rebelled against the Constitution and the United States, I don't think deserve to have statues put up in their honor.
Gil, thanks a lot for the call. Eric, what would be an honest way to represent our history, especially that Civil War era history, that I don't know, would inform our debates today, not kind of muddle them?
Well, you know, in Richmond, Virginia, they actually have at the old Tredegar Iron Works, which is now a kind of national park site museum about the Civil War, they have an interesting way of doing it where you've got like three narratives at the same time. You've got the Confederate view of the Confederate experience of the Civil War, you've got the Northern experience of the Civil War, and then you have the slaves' experience of the Civil War, which is not the same, obviously, as the Confederate. And you sort of get a picture that different people responded to this in different ways, and it affected people in different ways. And Robert E. Lee reflects one of those experiences, but obviously not the whole thing. But, you know, what was the first thing that the American soldiers did? Remember 2003 when they marched into Baghdad? They took down the statue of Saddam Hussein. Remember that? They didn't say, nobody jumped up and said, wait a minute, you're destroying history. Saddam Hussein is part of the history of this country. He may be a bad guy, but, you know, you can't just destroy history. No. When there's a regime change, statues tend to come down in many places. They did that in Russia, right, after the fall of communism. A lot of the statues of Marx or Stalin or others came down. I think they should be stuck in a museum somewhere if they're part of history. But being out in a public place as part of the public presentation of history to the people of Virginia or any state, that's a little different. If the Virginia Museum of Art wants to have a portrait of Robert E. Lee in there, fine, of course they should have that, no problem. But that's the museum presenting a work of art. That's not the city or the state saying, here is the person in Virginia history we ought to admire and emulate. That's a public thing, and it's a little bit different.
Eric, very briefly, we're 150 years out from the Civil War. Are we going to still be arguing about how to represent it in another 50 years?
Yeah, I'm sure we will. I won't be around to hear it, but absolutely. As long as these issues are still alive in American life, of racial inequality, of different groups and relations between these other, of politics and how race plays into that, unfortunately, I'm afraid in 50 years those issues will still be with us, and therefore the Civil War will still be debated by people.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure to talk to you. Bye-bye.
That's Eric Foner, professor of history at Columbia University, author of a number of books on American history, including Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, 1863 to 1877, and Battles for Freedom, the Use and Abuse of American History. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the president's latest comments on Charlottesville, on how we represent and remember the Civil War era in the United States, and presidential leadership. You can do that over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Prince passed away a little over a year ago, but the legendary musician just received a unique memorial, a color named in his honor.
Pantone, the group that names colors and pigments, announced the new color this week. They're working with Prince's estate on this. The color will be named with that symbol that Prince used as his name for a while, the love symbol. It'll be known, the color, in words as love symbol number 2.
The color will be a shade of, you'll never guess,
drumroll,
Had to be purple. Specifically, it's based on a custom-made purple piano that Prince was getting ready to take on his next tour.
So we did some painting in my house. We missed the opportunity to paint in Love Symbol number 2, but there's a couple rooms in our house that still have colors that we're kind of tired of. Would you want Love Symbol number 2 as a prominent color in your decor?
I like the color purple. I like Prince. And no, I probably wouldn't want to decorate with the paint, but it's cool that they have it.
Yeah, and then we asked people on Facebook, on the Central Time Facebook page, if there were a color named in your honor, what color would it be? Do you have any ideas?
For sure, I love red. It would have to be a red color.
A shade of red.
Yeah, what about you?
I'd have
Chartreuse?
To go... See, I have a limited color definition palette. Is that a kind of blue?
I think it's a kind of yellow-green.
Yellow, I think you're right. Right. No, yellow I would go green. With definitely something in the blue family.
Huh.
We'll honor the purple of Prince here on Central Time.